You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Protecting the Great Lakes and Michigan's natural resources, it's a crucial task that's best accomplished by Michiganders working together, and that means all Michiganders, including the First Peoples. So how can non-Indigenous people be good allies to Indigenous people in the quest for environmental justice? Kyle Powys-White is a Potawatomi environmental justice advocate, and he's an associate professor of philosophy and community sustainability at Michigan State University. Kyle, welcome to Stateside. It's good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me. It's good to have the chance to talk to you.
You say that you're often asked that very question, how can non-Indigenous people be good allies to Indigenous people, that other environmentalists ask you this question, and that the answer lies in understanding settler privilege. What is that?
That's a very important question, and what I think we need to understand with the idea of settler privilege is that we live in a society where the benefits, the economies, the overall ways of life are only possible from having dispossessed many Indigenous people of their lands and of their waters. And for people who benefit from that, who are not Indigenous, settler privilege is the idea that they oftentimes don't have to confront that reality in their daily lives.
And so how does that color our thinking?
Well, for example, oftentimes at the level of speech, you'll hear people say, oh, well, the United States gives Indigenous people, you know, land or gives them, you know, economic benefits or opportunities. And that can be extremely offensive to a lot of Native people because the U.S. hasn't actually given us anything, you know, right?
Au contraire.
Right, exactly.
It took away.
No, that's exactly right. And so oftentimes that language can be microaggressive. But then on the broader scale, much of the land in states like Michigan, you know, is stolen land. And the Indigenous people, the tribes in Michigan, are seeking to restore their sovereignty, their self-determination in those lands. Yet if you look at a lot of policies in Michigan, they don't really address that key issue for Native people.
So, Kyle, how do you answer people when they are talking with you and they ask you the question, how much of what happened and decisions that were made decades ago or centuries ago, how much of that lies on my shoulders in 2018? When someone who is non-Indigenous says that, what's your answer?
A lot still rests, I think, on people's shoulders because many of the same practices that occurred historically are still things that are enacted today. And so I think that for people living right now, they have a great responsibility to address their actual current complicity. So for example, a lot of environmentalists are very adamant that in Michigan, we need to do what we can to protect, you know, wilderness areas or to protect shorelines. But oftentimes when people say that, they're just thinking of those areas as places for recreation, whereas historically, there really was no wilderness or just, you know, open shoreline. Those were all areas that were part of Indigenous economies, Indigenous self-determination, culture, religious and spiritual practices. And so for a lot of Native people, I think that's what we want back. and we can't get that back if somebody else primarily sees those areas as recreation and leisure areas.
That's a good for instance. Well, for those of us with settler privilege, to learn how to be good allies to Native peoples, I understand there are certain approaches to be avoided, beginning with something called the romantic approach. Just what is that, Kyle?
So the romantic approach is this idea that I think a lot of the listeners will be familiar with. It's this idea that Native people have the best wisdom for protecting the environment, and that Native people have this special spiritual connection to the land, and that Native people never did anything that was harmful to the environment. And this is a view that stereotypes Native people, and it oftentimes just isolates a certain aspect of who we are. It just isolates the fact that we're sort of these people with this tremendous wisdom, and that it's a tragedy that our wisdom is not the prevailing way of life in the land. And so it ignores the political realities and struggles that we face as Native people. And it also doesn't allow us the opportunity to speak to our mistakes, right? It doesn't allow us the opportunity to be self-critical.
And what about this same boat approach? What is that, and why should that approach be avoided?
The same boat approach is something I oftentimes hear when I focus on the fact that, you know, for Native people, we really do want different things out of environmental work. We want to address racism. We want to address issues pertaining to sexism. We want to address, you know, numerous other issues that pertain to our experiences. And a lot of people say, oh, don't focus on, you know, racism, you know, don't focus on those issues. We need to just focus on, you know, big picture items like, you know, climate change mitigation that are common to everybody. And I really push back against that approach, because if you look at the history of the environmental movement, it's always been about trying to suggest that environmental problems are one and the same for all, but it's indigenous people that oftentimes don't benefit from environmental reforms as much as other people. I mean, take the national parks movement. Yeah, that was supposed to be about protecting the environment for all, yet many indigenous people were displaced off of their lands to make way for those national parks.
So if you're talking about environmental activism, what I think I hear you saying is non-indigenous people want to maintain or protect where indigenous activists are working to restore?
I think that's one way to put it, but I'd also add that for indigenous people too, we also have our own interventions and innovations that we're trying to do as well. So on the one hand, I think for a lot of Native people, we're trying to restore those practices and ways of life that come from our past and which can be particularly important for the future. But we're also tremendously adaptive people. You know, a lot of tribes I work with, including a lot of tribes in Michigan, they have hired their own scientists, many of whom are Native people, to do work on water quality, to do work on forestry. And I think the way that tribes do science is oftentimes different, where tribes really want to emphasize that if you're a scientist working for the tribe, you need to be accountable to the community. And so we're trying to restore, but we're also trying to innovate as well.
So we've talked about what not to do to avoid this romantic approach or this same boat approach. So let's turn to what we can and should do and the goal. And you write about decolonizing allyship. What is that and what does that look like?
That's a great question. So decolonizing allyship first means that we really need to look at, you know, what are the relationships that have really been damaged through the experience of U.S. and Canadian colonialism. And so in my work, I really highlight relationships like trust, consent, accountability, reciprocity, and many others. These are the relationships that are lacking. And so we first need to be able to engage in allyship in a way that tries to actually repair those relationships. So, for example, one thing that oftentimes happens is that an ally wants to really include Native people in a particular, you know, conservation project or pollution abatement project or climate change mitigation project, but they only invite the Native people to participate when the project is already underway. And, you know, if I want you to be part of something and I only ask you to be part of it once I've already started, you know, rolling out the project, you're not going to feel that that's a very trustworthy or consensual approach. And so Native people want to work with allies at the point of conception. And I think that's an important thing and an important lesson to learn, among many others.
Yes, and about that, what more can non-Indigenous peoples do to be true allies, to be respectful?
When we realize that our goals are to build those relationships back, it suggests that for allies, there's much more that they don't know about Native people than what they do know. And so the point of the discussion really should be, you know, how is it that Native desires for the future might be different from settler desires? And given that difference, not only how can we find points of overlap, but how can we appreciate those differences and those tensions and be open to them? And so in a lot of my work, I really talk about the fact that allies need to understand that for Native people, actually, we are kind of in a dystopian time already for our people and our cultures. And that suggests for us maybe a different approach about what we're saving, because we're not trying to avoid an environmental dystopia. We've already been through that. And so I think that's an important point of discussion for allies, to be open to that reality. But also, allies need to realize that it's true that I think Indigenous people should be respected for our intellectual traditions and our wisdom, but we also need to be respected for just being people who make mistakes, people who have adapted, and people who also can use things like Western science to our advantage.
And are you seeing this kind of true allyship? Have you got examples? Have you seen where it's working?
Well, one of the things I encounter is I'll meet a lot of, especially non-Native white people who have really applied a lot of powerful allyship practices and principles. You know, even people working for state government and federal government or nonprofit or universities. But what I find is that in the institutions that they work in, they're not incentivized to do that. So, for example, a lot of state and federal agencies have tribal liaison positions, but those positions are only a small percentage of the job of whoever holds it, and oftentimes they're only in that position for a short time, and it's not really valued as a career opportunity. And so I really hope that universities and agencies and others think, wait a minute, if we do have people that want to be good allies, they should be rewarded for that.
It should be more than window dressing.
Absolutely.
What do you see as the rewards of this decolonizing allyship, where non-Indigenous and Indigenous people really are allies in the best sense of the word?
The way I look at it, and in my work with scientists, I really try to emphasize this to them, is that for many Indigenous people, whether it's the 12 federally recognized tribes in Michigan or the over 560 federally recognized tribes in the United States, many other unrecognized tribes and state-recognized tribes and Native communities, we're undertaking one of the most critical projects in the world and in history, is that we're trying to rebuild our cultures, our self-determination in the wake of some of the worst human-inflicted violence ever. And I think that that is a tremendously powerful thing to do in one's life, to actually be part of that unfolding story. And that's what I think should motivate allies.
Kyle Powys-White is a Potawatomi environmental activist who is the Timnick Chair in the Humanities, as well as an Associate Professor of Philosophy and Community Sustainability at Michigan State University. Kyle, thank you so much for sharing your work and your views with us.
Great. Good to connect with you and the listeners.